Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
Eric, there is this thing that happened in late May that if you're a business journalist, you immediately sat up. And this was the results of an Exxon board meeting. And out of nowhere, something called Engine Number One showed up and basically all of corporate America took notice and ended up getting three board seats on ExxonMobil. And it speaks to a lot of things, and we're thrilled about this, but a couple of the folks at Engine Number One are going to join us today on Trillions. What stood out to you about that moment? Because it was not just about what an activist can accomplish with board seats.
Well, a couple of things. First, it's a small company who got bigger players to act. And I've always really looked at Vanguard and BlackRock and some of the institutional owners of having quite a bit of power. This is one of the issues we hear from people about how big passive is getting and their voting power. At the same time, you've got ESG ETFs coming out, which essentially score stocks and then exclude maybe some of the energy stocks. I've always struggled with those. Why wouldn't you want to own the people you want to help? So I looked at this and I was like, this makes a lot of sense to me. That, you know, voting and owning the shares is how you can really impact things, as opposed to just not owning Exxon. Let's work with them. And so I was immediately took notice. Then they filed for an ETF. And I was like, wow, this is interesting. And it's a really simple ETF. It's the 500 biggest stocks. And what I also found really intriguing was the expense ratio is 0.05%. So it's got a Vanguardian price tag. And the ticker's good, VOTE. So it's got a lot of things going for it. And I think it could redefine ESG investing. You know, if your goal is to have an impact, it just seems like this activist type ETF would be the way to do it versus, say, just not owning a couple energy stocks.
So the name of that ETF, Engine Number One Transform 500 ETF with the ticker VOTE. Joining us today from Engine Number One, Charlie Penner and Yasmin Dayabilger. Also joining us from Bloomberg Intelligence, ESG analyst Rob Duboff, and at Bloomberg News, an ESG reporter, Sejal Kishan. So one big happy family joining us for this very, very important interview, which I think of as almost the ultimate David and Goliath story. This time on Trillions, Engine Number One. Charlie, Yasmin, Rob, Sejal, welcome to Trillions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So Charlie, it's almost like you were flying in stealth mode and all of a sudden you shook corporate America in a really big way. You had a 0.02% stake in ExxonMobil, no history of activism in oil or natural gas, and all of a sudden you had scored three board seats, which was a quarter of what was available. And, you know, not long ago, Exxon was the world's most valuable company. So just tell me, how did you come out of nowhere here? How did you manage to pull that off?
The out of nowhere part, I might give a little, backstory on. So I spent 15 years doing traditional shareholder activism strategy at a very successful activist firm called John & Partners that does traditional activism. So focused on things like capital allocation, capital structure, and things like that. And we had actually done a fair number of campaigns in the energy space, companies like Houston Exploration and EQT and Kerr McGee. And, you know, in a lot of respects, this campaign was similar because before you got to the long-term picture that we viewed at Engine Number One as being a failure to appropriately prepare for the long-term changes facing the industry, there was just a basic bad capital allocation story, which quite frankly was worse in terms of value destruction than the other companies I mentioned. So in one respect, the very kind of basic near-term components of the campaign that looked at the last 10 years of value destruction in ExxonMobil, even before COVID struck, was in some ways very familiar. I think the thing that perhaps came out of nowhere was the additional element of the longer term focus on where can this company be 10, 20, 30 years down the road.
And I exaggerate. Obviously, you did not come out of nowhere because you actually had a very successful track record. And actually, just take a moment. And you have tussled with big companies before in that prior life, one being Apple, for instance. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. And just to be clear, you know, most of the time I spent at Jhana was executing and helping to execute on other people's ideas that were in that kind of traditional activist mold. What I spent the last few years at Jhana doing was campaigns that I had originated that were with that longer term focus. The thinking being that companies that think more long term will perform better over the long term. And if you're thinking long term, you're focused on things. In the case of Apple, like your relationship with your users. And you know, at that time in 2018, it was really the kind of beginning stages of the tech lash. And even though Apple hadn't really kind of come under that type of scrutiny yet, it didn't take a lot of looking around the corner when you looked at really the spike in negative mental health outcomes for the heaviest young users of the phone in terms of things like depression and loneliness and suicide risk factors and sleep deprivation. And the basic thinking was, this is something I'm still trying to do today, is basically if you look at positive impacts and long-term value creation potential as being two sides of the same coin, the basic argument at Apple was that if your goal as Apple is to move from being valued like a hardware company to being valued like a subscription-based recurring revenues company, and you want to do everything possible to keep people feeling safe and secure within the ecosystem, you'd want to do things to partner with families to give them really more dynamic control over the phones, which you have to combine with a lot of other things like good parenting and discussions and things. And fortunately for us, Apple very quickly said this makes sense. And you know, they called, Tim Cook was on the phone the next day with their biggest shareholder saying, what do you think of this? And they said, yeah, why wouldn't you do this? It makes sense. And the controls were really well received. They need to do more to market them, quite frankly. Google actually, which copied a lot of what Apple did, has done a better job marketing it. But it was a good first step. And I think kind of hopefully, you know, validated the case a little bit that focusing on these things isn't just about, you know, positive impact. It's just kind of good business sense too over the long term.
Well, and McDonald's was another one that you had at that moment in time too. And I guess that's going to be an interesting segue here, because when you engage with companies like this, sometimes it's public and sometimes it's not. Talk about the way that you dealt with McDonald's at that phase.
Yeah, and that was actually one that we previously had not named the company, but the New York Times, I guess, spoke to some other people and figured it out. That was actually the year after the Apple campaign. And the basic idea, again, there was to try to kind of marry the long-term value creation argument with the positive impact argument. In that case, you know, at least prior to the pandemic, McDonald's was a company that loses about 2% of its customers every year. And to make up for that, you know, they've been doing things like selling, you know, cheesy bacon on the fries and donut sticks with breakfast and stuff like that, which, you know, fine, but isn't necessarily, I think, by their own admission, a great long-term value creation strategy. So, you know, one of the reasons that they've been losing customers, and again, this is all pre-pandemic, is, you know, people looking for either healthier or flexitarian choices, where they're not looking to eliminate meat, but want to be able to reduce the intake of meat in a growing number of cases for environmental reasons. So the basic idea was they can both have a you know, positive impact on reducing their deforestation and methane emissions, and also appeal to customers who maybe have given up on McDonald's, particularly families with younger kids who, you know, may not feel great about, you know, kind of taking them there. Again, that's one where there's more work to be done, but they did introduce a partnership with Beyond Meat in Canada, which, you know, was marketed a certain way that maybe could be improved upon going forward. And now they have this McPlant concept that you know, we'll see what develops with that. But yeah, that was the one that followed Apple.
Which brings us sort of to engine number one. So how did that come into being? Because it's actually almost born at the beginning of the pandemic, right?
Yeah. So I met the founder of engine number one, Chris James, after the Apple campaign. And he at that time was formulating his thinking about what would eventually become engine number one, and very much focused on the idea that, you know, companies over time have to internalize their externalities in terms of their valuation, and that the investments that they make in their people, in their customers, in the society around them, in their communities, and in the environment. Ultimately, if you take a long-term time horizon approach, get reflected in the value. So, you know, he had a lot of ideas, you know, one of which ultimately came to the CTF. But what I was trying to do at Jhana fit very well into his kind of grander vision. So we kept talking, and yeah, I joined Engine Number One, you know, late last year, which feels like a longer time ago than it was. But yeah.
Yasmin, let me bring you into this. You and I met when you were at JP Morgan. You were an ETF person. You were one of the first guests on this podcast, actually. So, and then now you're here, and I guess, can you bridge everything Charlie's saying, because this is a new world for a lot of ETF investors. They're not even used to hearing stuff like this. And you're going to basically take some of this activism that Charlie just went over several examples of and democratize it in the ETF. Can you talk about the process to do that?
Yeah, sure. And maybe just taking a step back, since you referenced my time at JP Morgan, you know, one of the things I learned there, I was one of the early employees in JP Morgan's ETF business. I joined when that firm had one ETF and $25 million. And you know, when you look at the market dynamics of ETFs, one of the things you see is, wow, the space is crowded and it's concentrated. And so you sort of ask the natural question is, how does a new entrant come into the space and really think it's going to crack the code and grow? You know, JP Morgan was obviously very successful at doing that. I left when they had about $60 billion. But in my thinking of coming here, it's sort of what you were hitting on, Eric, when I was thinking about what is the value proposition of an Engine Number One type provider in the ETF space. And from my perspective, it was a couple things. The first is this idea of being purpose-built. So Engine Number One focuses only on impact. And I think that sort of focused mission statement, focused product set that we could drive off of it, was something that was actually quite unique in the market for this particular space of sustainability. And I think secondly, you know, a lot of the things that people talk about the sustainable investing world, you look at it and you think, wow, it's growing quite a lot, but it's still a drop in the bucket of all the ETF assets out there. So my hypothesis was something was holding that space back a little bit. And I think it really was a combination of, or is a combination of, one, investors really feeling this quandary between, can I invest in alignment with my values and the financial trade-off that you have to make? And two, this all feel like being tangible. There being a real so what to what they're doing. And so I think that's where the Engine Number One ETF business really fits well into the broader framework, as Charlie was talking about it. It's the ability to harness the power of all investors, be it the largest investors in the country, all the way down to the self-directed investor, give them a voice and a vote, pun intended, and really a seat at the table on some of these really important topics. And I think that value proposition is really unique.
And so let's just just for 1 second, stop here and just contrast this with ESG ETFs. ESG ETFs are going out scoring a bunch of stocks, and they all have their different methodologies. Typically, they won't own an Exxon, or they'll own it in a smaller, weighting. Can you talk a little bit about trying to position this? I'm trying to pretend you're in a meeting with an advisor or an investor. How are you explaining this versus, say, the onslaught of now 100 ESG ETFs out there?
Yeah, I think this is the really important point. There's been a lot of product development in the space, but to your point, they all sort of look and feel the same. It's either excluding or reweighting based on some ESG data point. They're basically ESG by what they own, but not what they do. And I think there's this, you know, real question you sort of have to ask yourself about what's the theory of change behind putting your money in one of those products? What changes if I were to move my entire savings account from the S&P 500 to something that slightly reweighted stocks based on scores? And I think that's maybe one of the things that holds back the end investor. I'm not sure that type of strategy is very real to them. So the premise of vote was actually quite simple on the investment side, as you said. It really was, if you have market cap and you like market cap and you like the price of market cap, you can keep all of those things. But where we're really going to drive value is the work we do as active owners, which from our perspective really spans a very broad spectrum of things. It's the votes we cast. It's the collaborative engagements that we run. In a small subset, it's also the work that Charlie's doing on the more activism side. And that's really where what we're doing is different. And my personal opinion is that we're solving those challenges I mentioned. One, we're not introducing a financial trade-off. Again, most people, virtually every investor has market cap in their portfolio. And so we're saying, if you like that, you can keep it the same. But two, we're allowing this to come to life with real tangible examples of how we're voting shares and hoping to change companies.
Charlie, when Chris described this strategy for you early on and was like, hey, I've got this idea to marry activism with an ETF, what was your first reaction to that?
I mean, it was described a little more broadly, and it's probably worth mentioning, you know, kind of that, you know, engine number one is multifaceted. I mean, there's the ETF, there's a more traditional, you know, more concentrated portfolio. There'll be additional, I believe, ETFs. There's some private investment stuff. So it was really presented as, and what was really interesting about it was the idea that all these different businesses would kind of be synergistic with each other. So, you know, the you know, as Yasmin said, the idea, I think, really behind engine number one is systemic change. So one way you can bring about systemic change is through these kind of targeted activist campaigns, right? Where you spend a year of your life and probably take off another 10 on the back end, you know, running a campaign like the Exxon campaign. But another thing you can do is, hopefully over time, as the ETF hopefully grows, is you kind of change the voting landscape. As you know, you were mentioning before, the unintended consequence of these ESG funds that are just focusing on the good actors is less accountability for folks who or companies maybe who should be doing things differently. And if you can grow this thing and also have an influence on the overall kind of voting proclivities of other funds as well, you can bring greater accountability, not just to a handful of companies a year who are going to be the subject of activist campaigns, but actually to the entire market. And it doesn't have to be a massive, you know, soul-sucking exercise like Exxon. It can be the smaller kind of shareholder engagements and votes that really, you know, change the kind of everyday discourse that people are having about environmental and social and long-term drivers of value at the biggest companies.
Sejal here. So Charlie, you mentioned systemic change. A lot of ESG issues, you know, be it climate change or, you know, racism here in the US, these are huge systemic issues. A number of people have said, you know, have said like divestment campaigns, ETFs, low carbon funds, all of these sort of like products are not really enough to address these issues on the timeframe that we need, especially with climate change. So how do you sort of like react to that, you know, when it comes to like ETFs addressing something like climate change in the next 10 years or so?
Yeah, we would, you know, agree with those people. It's kind of the founding principle, which is if you are looking to bring about change within a time frame that is soon enough to be consequential, divestment in most cases is not going to do that. You know, companies like ExxonMobil are not hurting for capital. So look, it's not to knock anybody's investment choices. You know, everyone can make their own decisions. But our opinion is that you can't just ignore the companies that are most in need of change. And it doesn't, to us, feel great just not to be invested in them. We'd rather be invested in them, be able to give investors in the ETF broad market exposure at a very low price, and be able to, you know, again, through the vote, through collaborative engagement, and in a subset of cases, through an activist approach, impose, we hope, greater accountability on the market to deal with those issues, which again, we think are, as long as you have a long-term time horizon, which we think most investors do, really fundamental long-term value drivers for these companies, you know, answering these questions the right way.
Maybe just one thing just to add on to what Charlie was saying there on the voting side, just to underscore the point a little bit. I think most investors don't know how their shares are being voted. And I think that that's actually one of the sleeping giants in this room, if you think about it. you know, the average S&P 500 fund has, if you look historically at voting track records, has voted against, let's call it 70 to 90% of environmental and social shareholder proposals over the last 5 to 10 years. And I think A, investors don't know that, and B, they also don't necessarily know they have a choice in that. And that maybe sort of speaks to the power of harnessing all investors here. There's trillions of dollars behind that, right? If we could actually just provide a layer of transparency to that and provide an alternative, that in and of itself may actually have some pretty profound impact and change. And so, you know, I guess the ETF is named that way for a reason. I do think that the voting part actually has the potential to be really interesting and transformational.
You know, Vanguard and BlackRock are passive owners and or index fund, and they're the top two owners of most companies out there. They own about 8%, 9% of every company pretty much. And you talked about this voting record. Now, we in the industry, they're starting to get more transparent. They'll tell you how they voted a lot of times with management. And I don't know, if I'm not in there, I can't grade them myself. I'm not really that involved. But I guess, could you talk a little bit about this idea? I use the metaphor of a tugboat. That engine number one, even though engine's a train, I like the name, by the way. I use the metaphor of a tugboat where, you know, maybe you guys are able to tug these bigger owners into a direction they might not go on their own. They might not propose this or be the catalyst for some of these, but they'd be willing to go along with that. So can you talk about that relationship and moving them towards your side on these issues?
I guess what Eric's trying to say was tugboat number one ever in the name conversation?
No, but it probably should have been. You know, it's probably not too late. You know, I think that the way I think about it, at least, is you have to be meeting a market need. So if you think about, you know, the early 2000s, you know, the kind of modern wave of shareholder activism, you know, it was meeting a market need, which was that challenging companies where either the CEO was an empire builder or the board paid management as if they were top performers when they were actually, you know, bottom quartile performers. And it wasn't institutional investors didn't care about those issues, but if you're voting, you know, 10,000 proxies a year and you're engaging with hundreds or thousands of companies every year and you have, you know, a full-time job, you're not going to take off 6 months or a year to do kind of a deep dive into those companies and make these types of proposals. So in the same way that the traditional and still very successful activist funds like Jhana and others met a market need, you know, I think funds like BlackRock and Vanguard and others are absolutely sincere when they talk about the need for companies to have a plan for the energy transition and to deal with other important issues. But it is not their business model. They don't have the time and whatever other kind of personality traits or defects that you need to take kind of an activist approach. And so if we can offer hopefully compelling arguments and good candidates that, you know, we spent the better part of a year trying to find, I don't view us as really pushing them in any particular direction. I think they're sincere when they say they care about those issues, but we're meeting a market need, which is employing a dedication of time and a particular set of resources and skills that hopefully can be helpful in giving them a choice. You know, most of the time they don't have a real choice in situations and with companies like Exxon when it actually comes time to casting your vote. And if we can offer them something, if we do a good job, it helps kind of move the ball forward in a way that's consistent with their goals as opposed to pushing them in some new direction.
Hi, Rob here. I just wanted to chime in with a follow-up question. I mean, obviously, BlackRock and Vanguard have been mentioning for years their interest in climate change. You know, Larry Fink has written that letter. But more recently, in the last year or so, social issues have become more and more important. And you obviously mentioned the Apple campaign earlier. I'm just wondering, are there any opportunities on the social side, particularly around diversity, inclusion, and equality?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that, you know, the social can be more difficult to quantify. But, you know, whether it's diversity and inclusion, whether it's human capital management, whether it's responsible technological development, These are playing a massive role in things like income inequality, which is a massive drag on economic growth, on weakening of democratic small d institutions around the world, which is a threat to the very system of capitalism that we all operate within. And so, yeah, absolutely. I think the S in ESG can be just as impactful. You know, you're probably stirring with a longer spoon, quite frankly, because you're not really getting so much into issues of like basic capital allocation and things that were more kind of meat and potatoes in the Exxon campaign. But I think they absolutely can drive a great deal of long-term value and also destroy a lot of long-term value if you don't answer those types of questions correctly.
Yeah, touching on what Joel and both and what Rob have asked about Exxon, that campaign was largely based on the financials of the company. How do you push for change on ESG issues when a company isn't doing so well on S issues, but financially are performing well?
Yeah, you still have to root it in the financials. I mean, look, we are not adding a whole lot of value if we can't, by some means, quantify, you know, what we're talking about. But, you know, it can be certainly a lot more difficult. I mean, even, you know, any campaign that we're going to be doing is not going to have the, you know, ability to break it down as cleanly as, you know, for example, in a traditional activist campaign, if you're pushing for a share buyback, you can say what the new denominator is going to be, or you are asking a company to spin off an underperforming division, and you can say, here's what SpinCo is going to trade on, here's where RemainCo will trade, and you can kind of neatly quantify those things. So even on the environmental side, you know, we could say what we thought the impact of better capital allocation, more disciplined and consistent capital allocation policies would be. But in terms of, you know, the longer term, you know, giving the market a reason to think that even in a decarbonizing world of lower oil and gas demand, that ExxonMobil will still have a reason for being in 20 or 30 years. That's pretty difficult to quantify. You know, on the social front, I mean, take, you know, the Apple campaign. It's difficult to say exactly what the precise impact of, you know, better, more dynamic controls for parents would be. But that's also kind of the nature of that business. I mean, what they're doing on the privacy front, what they're doing on augmented reality, what they're doing on Animojis and group FaceTime, you know, they don't break those things out into separate kind of menu items that people pay more for. So in some ways, that's kind of the nature of that business. But at the end of the day, you still have to be able to break it down into, you know, either revenue growth, you know, hopefully in the case of fast food companies that offer more plant-based protein substitutes as time go on to meet growing customer demands. You have to be able to translate it into profitability, certainly with human capital management. There are a lot of companies that have shown that by investing more in people, you actually increase basic metrics like sales per square foot and EBITDA per square foot. So, you know, look, we have to be able to make, for at least for the activist campaigns, arguments that will appeal not just to ESG-focused investors and stakeholders, but to you know, basic long-term investors. And that will require at some point talking about how it impacts revenues or profitability or the multiple or some other, you know, metric that people look at, you know, when they're valuing these companies.
One thing to maybe add on that, because we now that we've been in market for a couple of weeks now on an index fund, one of the questions we get a lot is, but wait, what is the value proposition here from an economic side if you're basic premise is to track an index, and therefore, you know, why you even need an economic argument behind what you're doing if you're not going to take, by definition, an outsized position. And you know, it's something that I've actually thought quite a lot about as I think about this new product where we're actually specifically trying to be market cap oriented. I mean, at a high level, of course, the entire firm has places in its portfolio where it leans into concentration when we have a strong economic view. So, you know, I think point one is that engine number one ties the impact we're doing to economic value. But two, you know, we're only ever going to be as successful as the investors we can bring along with us. And as Charlie was mentioning, you know, the ETF, you know, even if we're wildly successful and we meet $10 billion, $100 billion, you can extrapolate how big that product can grow. You still need to actually build a coalition of people around you and make reasonable shareholder arguments for what you're doing. So, I do feel like even the index side of the argument actually still has it's stronger when you tie it to an economic value proposition.
One of the things that we have noticed is, and I'm not sure if you have a prepared answer for this, but people love the S&P 500. There's just something about that brand name. And we have the Bloomberg 500, and I think that's actually better. They were S&P was way too late to take in Tesla. It's basically an actively managed fund in a way. Here's a more beta, a real beta index you guys track in the Morningstar one. Yeah, there, people are really hooked on this index. How do you try to dislodge somebody who has like an IVV or a VU tracking the S&P 500 with this?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question because, I mean, the intentional design behind this product is we're trying to simplify the investment decision as much as possible. So if you have something you like, as much as we can, you should try to keep it. You know, at a high level, the Morningstar index that we're tracking is exposure to the largest 500 companies weighted by market cap in the US. So sounds very similar, and it is very similar from a long-term tracking error perspective. So I do think we've met the objective of actually having a very similar exposure. But I'll also say Morningstar is a partner. It's a fabulous partner for us. I think what they're doing in the index space is actually quite disruptive. In some sense, maybe similar to how we're thinking about ourselves and the world we operate in. So I also have the added benefit of, you know, a like-minded partner with us. But in effect, you know, now that I've been in market a couple of weeks talking to investors, I do think that while there are all these small nuanced differences between standard US equity large cap indexes, they're essentially very similar. And most investors don't really see much of a difference.
Hey, it's Rob here again. Just on the management fee, 5 basis points, obviously that helps attract AUMs. That obviously puts more muscle behind your campaigns, but then is it sustainable to run these activist campaigns with that? You know, I heard the Exxon campaign, I think, was $12.5 million. Is it sustainable to keep running campaigns like that with just 5 basis points?
Yeah, and again, this is important to keep in mind, as I mentioned, you know, earlier, that, you know, engine number one now has an ETF, but it has other strategies as well, including, as Yasmin mentioned, more concentrated portfolios. So we are bringing more to the financial picture than just the 5 bips that the ETF is bringing. But yeah, I don't think it would make a lot of sense to have a solely an ETF that's charging 5 bips and be running multiple, you know, $12 million campaigns every year. But that's not what we're doing.
Maybe just to add to that, I mean, I think there was a very intentional choice with having our first ETF, and we plan on having more ETFs, be the one that we chose to launch, which is that it's what, like I said, what most people have in their portfolios. So, you know, this type of product that speaks to a wide range of investor, both from institutional to self-directed, and is sort of a standard part of everyone's portfolio, gives us access and breadth in an investor base, which I think is really valuable to the firm. So as Charlie mentioned, this is one of multiple strategies we run, but I also think it's got a really interesting strategic angle for the broader firm.
You know, I just want to ask one quick question, Yasmin, which is, we just did an episode about tickers and how people claim good tickers. How did you get vote?
It blows my mind and it makes me so happy. And I saw that you had done that session. I tickers are so important. People who aren't ETF people don't necessarily gravitate too much toward it. But as someone who's built so many ETFs in my life, it is so important to get the right ticker. And when we got vote, it was just one of those amazing moments because it says what it is. I mean, it's really basically the way we think about the product is like you have a voice, take your seat at the table, and like we're pushing on an open door when we use the word vote. So we're really lucky to have grabbed that one.
You know, interesting talking about vote and voting rights. You do have some companies in the S&P or among the 500 largest, particularly tech companies, which we talked about earlier, where you don't have that one share, one vote. You know, how do you work with those companies where maybe the power of voting isn't all there as it is for some other companies?
Yeah. Well, it's certainly more of a challenge. I think, you know, it still goes back to having to make compelling economic arguments. So, I mean, if you look at Apple, you know, it might have well have been a dual share class company, right? At the time, I think the market cap was $900 billion. And even with California State Teachers Retirement System joining us, we had like a $1 billion position. So can you, you know, take them to a vote at the annual meeting and toss people off the board? No, but you can still make compelling long-term arguments. And it's ironic, actually, some of the tech companies, I won't name names, who justify high-low vote structure by saying, well, we want to look out for our long-term value creation interests, you might argue, are taking an overly short-term approach to their business model. But if you can, make a compelling argument that they can, be more valuable over the long term by answering some of these questions differently and get shareholders to concur, you can still get things done. But you're right, you are missing in those cases the ultimate hammer, which is putting different people on the board if they don't come along. But I still think in a lot of situations it can be worth trying, and I think will be worth trying as time goes on here.
Sejal here again. One for you, Charlie. People in the ESG space who've been doing this for like many decades are talking again about structural change and targeting policy and things like that. Are you planning to do any sort of like lobbying or anything like that if you want to sort of push for systemic change?
I think that it's, never say never. And certainly things that impact investor rights and board accountability, certainly are within our purview. And that's something that, even before coming to Engine Number One, was something that I've worked on from time to time. But I would say that, we do recognize that a lot of these issues are issues that will play out in a complex global system, and in many cases the regulatory environment will have a heavy impact on those. It's one of the reasons why, for example, on the ExxonMobil board, we thought it was important to have somebody like Andy Karsner, who, in addition to being a galaxy brain type when it comes to the energy transition, also spent time as Assistant Secretary of Energy and has stayed in that kind of milieu, including with the current administration. So we understand that in a lot of these cases, the regulatory and the technological, as well as the investor community focuses, will all kind of intersect. Would that ever lead to getting involved in kind of non-investor related policy lobbying efforts? It's not something that I think currently being contemplated, but I guess never say never if it made sense. But we recognize that our lane is really making arguments that will appeal to investors. I think in most cases that's a separate lane from what's going on with policymakers.
So let's talk about that lane and just going forward, Charlie. How do you decide what you're going to engage in and what you're not going to engage in? And how are you looking through that lens? How is Engine Number One looking at the future?
First thing is you got to make sure that you have a path to victory. I mean, I know a lot of people looked at the Exxon campaign and thought that, we were taking a flyer, but we really weren't. If I didn't think, and if everyone looking at it didn't see a clear path to victory, and that means, counting potential votes, it's not a great use of a year of your life, if there's no way to win. The gating item is always, can you be successful? And then after that, you look at, the value creation opportunity, you look at the impact opportunity. And again, those should, for a good campaign, will be joined at the hip. And then you weigh it against other opportunities that you're looking at. I mean, you don't have a infinite number of campaigns that you can pursue every year. And so you try to, make the ones that are most compelling from a value creation and, kind of narrative perspective. Take precedence.
So if you think about this in years of your life, how long of a list do you have ahead of you?
God, it's such a grim question. I mean, it's kind of playing my mortality and then what I'm going to be, how long I'm going to be sitting at this desk.
We invited you on a podcast, but you can also lay down on like a couch if you need to.
I honestly just kind of, I think just think from campaign to campaign, and there's lots of other ideas that we're working on now that I think, and they're not all Exxon type ideas in the sense that they will require taking things to a vote. I mean, most activist situations, you know, get resolved constructively and usually privately. So hopefully there'll be a fair number of those, certainly more of those than campaigns like Exxon. But, you know, as long as we can keep coming up with good ideas that we think will be compelling to people, you know, no plan to stop doing it.
Sejal here again. So I'm not going to ask you what your next campaign is, because I know you're not going to answer it. But can you give us an idea of what theme that you're planning to tackle, be it the environment, be it racial discrimination, worker pay, income inequality? What's your next theme?
I mean, really all of the above. I can tell you that there is more to do, certainly on the IOC front. There is more to do, not just on the supply side of the climate change and energy transition issue, but on the demand side, I'd say a lot more to do. I think that on the human capital management front, there's a lot to do in kind of marrying the idea of good operational decisions, enabling greater investment in people. I think on the responsible technological front, there's a ton of work to be done. So working on a bunch of different stuff, and it's just a question of you know, when the work gets done, when the timing is right, and you know, when we're sure that you know we're more likely to be successful than not. So I think there's a lot of interesting stuff coming down the pike, hopefully.
Sure. But what's going to be the focus, though? I mean, there's a lots of ESG issues there.
The focus will be systemic change. It'll be on things that aren't tweaks to a business model and are not the type of thing where, you know, say, for example, like, you know, a lot of funds, you know, focused on percentages. Can you increase this percentage? Can you decrease that percentage? What we'd like to do is propose things that offer a better and more long-term and more sustainable, in every sense of the word, business model. So I can tell you that there's a couple things that could see the light of day this year that fall into that category, and they are not in the energy space. Is that more precise? Sure.
Well, systemic change is quite a nebulous sort of concept. So why don't you guide us a little bit more towards sort of the theme that you're looking at there?
Sejal, I'm doing my best here.
I'm doing my job as well.
I don't want to ruin the surprise. I think that you'll like it. We'll talk when the time comes, Sejal, I promise.
Can this thing go global? I mean, obviously you have different shareholder rights structures globally. So, you know, can you build an international index in addition to US index with this similar concept?
I hope we see more versions of our strategy beyond just the S&P 500 or, you know, Morningstar 500 type of exposure. I mean, ultimately, the value proposition we're trying to think about with this product set is, let's find pockets of core market cap assets where they're large, they're meaningful, and investors use them in building portfolios. Clearly, the US is, you know, different cuts of the US is a more kind of simple extension story. So small cap, mid cap, value, growth. But I do think, you know, the concept of what we've done here, what we've cracked the code, is not just niche to what we've done. There's many other places we can go with it. Personally, for me, I want to see where investors bring us on that. I think it's going to be most interesting to see how this product is received and where people actually want to pull us from the concept of other indexes with similar active ownership strategy.
There's certainly no reason it couldn't. I mean, most of the non-US markets, they actually have, at least in terms of the actual rights that shareholders have, fairly robust rights. It's really more a question of the local market and kind of shareholder attitudes, quite frankly, which, you know, I think are bigger determinants of whether or not it makes sense to enter a particular country. But there's in most situations, there's no reason why you can't, as long as you have a good handle on the kind of attitudes of the shareholder base.
Yasmin, it's a question we ask at the end of every Trillions. What is your favorite ETF ticker that is not your own?
Oh my gosh. I actually do like she and just maybe just keeping it in the space of sustainability keeping it very simple to what those products were trying to achieve. Yeah.
And Charlie, how about you?
I don't know if I ever gave more than 30 seconds of thought to an ETF a year ago. I just Googled them. I'll go with VOO, VOO. No idea what it is, but it rolls off the tongue.
All right, there you go. Charlie, Yasmin, Sejal, Rob, thank you all so much for joining us on Trillion.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you like to listen. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. I'm at Joel Weber Show. He's at Eric Balchunas. You can find more about Engine Number One at engineone.com. This episode of Trillions was produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcasts. Bye!